Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
I want to be the best operator I could possibly be, the best leader I could possibly be. I want to be a better leader and operator today than I was yesterday. And then that transfers over to today. I want to be a better author today than I was yesterday. I want to be the next book to be better than this one. I want the next TV show to be better than the last one. It's a constant game of improvement going forward.
I'm Steve Murphy, DEA Special Agent retired and now host of the Game of Crimes podcast. If you've seen the Netflix series Narcos, then you know my story. I now bring you stories of heroism and bravery from our law enforcement and military heroes, and occasionally from the criminals that they faced. Welcome to Game of Crimes. Hey, gang, welcome to this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Like I say every week, another fantastic guest coming on this week. Somebody you might have heard his name before, even I had, so that's a little unusual because, you know, I'm not big into TV and movies and stuff like that except what we rate here on the show. But let me just give you his background. 20 years in the U.S. Navy as a Navy SEAL from 96 to 16. I told him, I was wondering, well, maybe he was with us in Columbia back in the early 90s and just made me feel old when I found out when he really joined the SEALs. In there, he operated as a sniper, an assault team leader, a platoon commander, and a special ops task force commander. He's got deployments in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Philippines. I saw where he retired as a lieutenant commander, which is an officer. So we're not going to salute him or anything. But he's also, and this is a giveaway, he's a New York Times bestseller a whole lot more than one time. I mean, just anything he writes seems to just go crazy. He's a host of not one, but three podcasts. The most, probably the best known is Danger Close, which yours truly and my old partner, Javier Penn, you got to be a guest on his show recently. That was a true honor. He's a public speaker and he's a true entrepreneur. So ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Jack Carr to the show. Jack, welcome to Game of Crimes.
Thank you so much for having me. It was so great to talk to you on Danger Close about the fourth option. So those should be dropping here around the time of the book. I want to talk to people who had touch points with the world that I explore in that novel. And yeah, one thing from the background, I think you mentioned it, but I don't want to gloss over. I was definitely started enlisted. So I was enlisted for 6.5 years. I want to make sure we point that out because you fussed around the officer part of it, but the enlisted part of it and the sniper part of it, that's, I don't know, it gives you a little foundation because that comes from popular culture. I mean, it comes from me watching all these Vietnam movies growing up, and every time they had the brand new officer shows up in Vietnam, and what does he do? He leads his men right into an ambush on every single time. So I didn't want to be that guy. So anyway.
Well, yeah. That speaks highly to your character that you wanted to learn from the ground up. So that's a very admirable trait to start with. I'm sure there's not a lot of people that do it. But just so we know, I met Jack through Patrick O'Donnell, who's the host of Cops and Writers podcast. Patrick, thank you so much, brother, for the intro. You guys have heard me talk about Patrick on a lot of shows here. He's been a guest on the Game of Crimes, and we continue to work together on different projects. So thank you, brother. But I want to, you mentioned your new book. This episode is coming out on May 12th. Today is May 12th. And it just so happens your book came out today.
It did. It did. Now, this is a galley copy. So right here, this is not the final. And I'm not a big fan of the galley copies because they're essentially still rough drafts that publicists get out there to reviewers ahead of time, that sort of a thing. But I never send them out anymore because they're not the best product. There's still changes that I made after this, after these were printed. So, but today is May 12th. It's out in hardcover, ebook, and audiobook, narrated by Ray Porter, who is now in the Audible Hall of Fame for his work as a narrator. He's such a great guy. I got so fortunate when I chose him, and I chose him just for his voice because I'm not an audiobook person. I need that physical book. I'm a reader,
right.
And I didn't know much about audiobooks. So I listened to a bunch of kind of snippets from Audible, little samples, and I found Ray Porter, and I thought, oh, this guy's voice is great. I wonder if he'll do this. And I asked Simon & Schuster before the book came out, and I had no idea that he was at the top, like the pinnacle of the narration pyramid. And he has a following that follows him around from project to project, yeah. regardless of the author. So anyway, he's a great guy. We've become dear friends over the years, and the audiobook drops today as well.
Well, it shows you got good judgment there. I mean, you're on Game of Crimes. What better can that, how much better does life get, right?
I don't know anything else about judgment other than coming on here. Speaks volumes.
So your new book, David over at Simon & Schuster was nice enough to send me a PDF copy. Is the final version much different from the PDF?
It is. I mean, it's actually much different, but I mean, the story is the same, but it's those details, and those details really matter to me. And so I keep tweaking those up until the final second. I keep sending it out to subject matter experts as I make edits and say, okay, my buddy from EOD, hey, can you check this again? I made a change here. Can you look at this? And my dog handler buddy, hey, I made a change here. Does this make sense to somebody who's a dog handler? FBI buddy, hey, I did this thing here. Would this ring true to someone who's an FBI agent? So I do that constantly up until the very last minute. I'm sure it drives my publisher crazy, but I really want to get those details right, because it honors those guys who have done those jobs. If I put that effort into those details, so I really try to do that, and that foundation of authenticity is really, I guess, a hallmark now of all my books.
Well, and you mentioned DEA heavily through there too. So proud to see DEA portrayed in a positive light, because they we're not drunk every afternoon, like the initials say.
it's funny. I should have used that. That would be fantastic. I'll use that in the future book. But yeah, a great DEA character in there, and really got to know that guy over the course of writing the book, just because you get to know these characters as you, and I get to know them. Like, I knew when I start off, I put out my characters, their names. I know like what their position is, and I know essentially if they're a good guy, a bad guy, or if they're somewhere in the middle, just somebody who moves the plot forward, regardless of good, bad, or indifferent. But I don't know them yet. And then I get to know them when I put them in conversation with someone else. And so that's where I really get to know the person. And then little idiosyncrasies pop up, and just things happen as I write about them. And like this guy having a cigar, and they're not being an ashtray, so he uses a spoon and wraps it in a napkin so you can finish it later, and all this stuff. Like all these little things that aren't part of my outline or part of my initial kind of character assessment or write-up. I get to know them in conversation. And so that DEA character, I really got to enjoy writing him. So I wouldn't be surprised if he shows up in a future novel.
You done good. So if you need any DEA advice, all you got to do is ask.
Thank you. We'll be reaching out in the future for sure.
Thank you, brother. Now, question for you, is this a continuation of the James Reese and your others, or this is a new thing?
This is a new one. So James Reese has the first seven, and then I have James Reese's dad, Vietnam 1968 with Cry Havoc. And that one took me so long, because writing in 1968 and writing characters who I can only have their life experience up to 1968 applied to a conversation or a problem set or whatever else is happening in the book. And that just took so much more time than I initially thought at the outset. So I got a little bit behind in the series, but the first seven are James Reese, then one for his dad, Tom Reese in Vietnam, and then this is a new series. And it was one of the ideas I had when I first sat down and put all these ideas on paper. What I essentially did is took like a couple paragraphs, sometimes two, sometimes three, sometimes four, but one page executive summaries. And I put that on the table in the fall of 2014. And as I was getting ready to leave the Navy, and I thought, okay, what is the book that I need to start with? And it was very clear to me that that was the Terminal List out of the gate. That was the one. But I kept thinking about this other one, that's the fourth option. And I revisited it in the summer of 2021 when we were filming the television show out in Los Angeles. I had a day off, and I was in my hotel room thinking through, hey, what are some other ideas that I can explore here outside the James Reese Terminal List universe? And I went back to those ideas that I had written down in 2014, and then I expanded upon the fourth option. And then I got home. We finished up in LA, got home, and turned that into a 40-page PowerPoint presentation where I attached actors and almost like a mood board type thing. So I had actors attached to characters, the character backgrounds. I had pictures of New Orleans and kind of to set the mood and all that stuff and explain the story in a PowerPoint so that I could pitch it to Hollywood, because I thought I need to focus on the James Reese Terminalist series. I don't have time to write another book right now. I mean, some guys can't. John Grisham can do two in a year. Michael Connelly can do two in a year. But I think their children are older and out of the house, which I think might help with the time they can allot to writing. So I'm not quite there yet. But I can only do the one a year, I felt at this point. And then I pitched them to Hollywood in two different ideas. One was the fourth option, and there was another one. I got picked up in Hollywood. And then I saw those ideas, those treatments, those outlines, those very robust outlines morph once we got people attached to the projects. And for some reason, that bothered me. Whereas with the books, it doesn't bother me to see those change as they get adapted for screen. And I think that's because people can always go back to essentially the primary source document, the book, and that's the best that I could do at the time. And so that's always out there. But with these other projects, if it's just my idea and an outline and a treatment, and then they morph and maybe into something at the end unrecognizable from my original idea, that bothered me. So I had the opportunity to claw them back. And so I did. And I thought, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to turn these into books. But right now I have to focus on the James Reese Terminalist universe. I have the scripts and I have the books. I need a co-author to do this with. So it took me a long time to find a co-author, but found M.P. Woodward, former Navy intelligence officer, naval intelligence officer, great guy. I found him through a book called The Handler, which was fantastic. And called him and asked him if he'd wanted to work together, and he did. So sent him those all the information I had on the fourth option, that big PowerPoint presentation. And then we went back and forth for a few months putting together the outline. And then he got me a rough draft. And then I took it from the next few months and got it to where I felt it needed to be. And now that's the final version that's out there. And I could not be more pleased with how it came out. But that's the backstory with how the fourth option came to life.
Well, we're not going to tell you about the book, folks. We're not going to give you the details. But you hear me say this about almost everybody that comes on the show that's written a book. You can't put it down. Well, my wife, she'd wake up at 3:30 in the morning and she's like, "What are you doing up?" And it's like, "This book, I can't put it down." But I want to ask you some questions about yourself here. So a lot of people know you as a warrior, as the author, as the public voice. But how different are you from what the public sees from the man that your closest friends actually know? Are you the same person, or is there a dichotomy there between personalities?
No, I'm exactly the same. It would be hard to not be. I mean, I guess you could, but that'd be exhausting to try to like be someone else publicly, especially today. You know, maybe you could have pulled it off in the 80s or 90s if you're just showing up for a singular interview on something and then you're going back to doing whatever you're doing. But today, I think that'd be almost impossible, and it'd be a horrible way to live. I couldn't do it anyway. So, and I was talking to a dear friend of mine from kindergarten, first grade, and she was saying, "You're exactly the same person today as you were on the slide in the playground in first grade." So it's just always been that way, and I don't know how to be anything else. So
that's encouraging. Yeah. What is it people assume about you that they're getting completely wrong?
Ooh, I don't know. Maybe that there's a formula to all this, that that once you get on the radar in publishing, then there's a kind of a formula to books, or there's advice that your publisher, your agent gives you, because that's kind of what I had from the outside looking in. I had no touch points with publishing or Hollywood. My only touch point was popular culture. So that TV show Californication and the TV show Entourage, and there's agents in those, and they're, that's not how my agent is. And no one in publishing or at my talent agency gives me any advice. And I really like that. I didn't know what it would be like stepping into that world. I thought I'd step in, and then all of a sudden you have all this experience with your agent and your publishing house, and they say, "Hey, this was good, but this is what we think you should do next," or "This is what we've seen work for someone with a continuing type of a series character," or zero advice at all. And I love that, because whether people love it or hate it, it's all on me. There's no bandwidth wasted on, let's say, political capital, meaning I don't have to say, "Oh, my agent said I should do this. I don't know if I should, blah, blah, blah." Then I write the book and I took the advice maybe and it doesn't work. And then I can blame her, you know, like, "I knew I shouldn't have done that." So that doesn't exist. It all comes down to one person only, and that is me. And I like that. There's no one else to blame if I get anything wrong.
wrong or if a book doesn't work, it all comes down to me. And so I like that part of it. So I think maybe people assume that there's more help or something than there is out there. There's, you know, there's more of a paradigm type of a model or something like that. And that's really not my experience. It might be someone else's experience, but it certainly isn't my experience. So that's a misconception I had, or it was an unknown, I guess. It wasn't a misconception. It was just an unknown because I didn't have anybody to talk to. I knew nobody else in that world. So that's probably a misconception, maybe, is that used to that world. And then there's a model to follow. And there really isn't.
Got it. When we wrote our book, we were smart enough to hire a ghostwriter.
Yeah.
She's a fine job. There you
go. Yeah, there you go. I don't know any other authors that that do that. So I guess more like Hollywood, I guess. I should say that. I guess I've heard that Hollywood people do that, and that's fairly common out there because, you know, that's their focus on acting or whatever they're focused on.
Right.
And not in every case, but I've heard that's more common, but not so much in the world of fiction.
You know? Yeah. So when you left the SEAL teams, what part of yourself did civilian life have no use for whatsoever?
Oh, I don't know. I never really thought of it in those terms. I did think about how hard it was for other people I saw leaving ahead of me to turn the page on the SEAL team chapter of their life. So I was very aware of that. And I just, because right before I got out, I went to the BUDS, which is our SEAL training pipeline. And so it's a training command. So I wasn't taking guys down range anymore for the first time. So I didn't feel that obligation to spend every single waking moment focused on being a better operator and leader, because I knew I was getting out, and BUDS is it's moving. That train is moving. It's been moving for a long time. You have senior enlisted guys and officers in every single phase. It's push-ups and sit-ups. And it was the first time I could really take a breath and look around, because up to that point, I was taking guys down range. And so every single second of my life was focused on being a better leader, better operator, because that goes back to popular culture again. Once again, I didn't want to be the character that I saw in television, in film, and read about in books as a kid from Vietnam, sitting on that couch with a bottle of whiskey with a pistol next to me, wondering if I could have done something different. In this case, in the battlefield in Vietnam, that was the ghost that essentially haunted main protagonists in books and films and television shows in the 80s, because that was the war they were closest to. And I didn't want to be that guy. I think it really made an impression. And I wanted to at least be able, even if things went south, to know that I didn't leave anything on the field when it came to training and preparation. So that pendulum had to be on the side of the team. My wife knew that. My family knew that. That's just how it is when you're taking guys down range. You have to be solely focused on that. So then I get to this position at BUDS where I know I'm getting out in a couple of years. I'm at a training command. I'm now not going to take guys down range anymore. That part of my life is behind me. And then I saw guys leaving the military, leaving the SEAL teams. And I saw them have a very difficult time doing that. Not every case, but I noticed it. And it's like they built a foundation and it was still a little bit wet, but their feet got stuck in that foundation. They couldn't build off it. They stayed mirrored in it. And so I recognized that as something I didn't think it would happen to me, but because I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to write. I knew I had known that since I was a little kid. I've been reading my entire life, especially during those years where you're very impressionable. So let's say age 8 to 18 or 10 to 20. I think whatever you do during those years really imprints on your brain as it's forming. And luckily for me, I was reading all these books, reading books by the masters like Tom Clancy and Nelson DeMille and A.J. Quinnell and J.C. Pollock and Mark Olden, David Morrell, all of these masters in the art of storytelling who essentially became my professors unbeknownst to me because I was just disappearing into the magic of those pages. So I knew I would write afterward, but I'd already given myself this education and it continues through today, it's my whole life. And that's fiction and that's nonfiction as well, because I'm always studying warfare. I'm a student of everything that I do. But I noticed that guys had a hard time leaving the SEAL teams. Just like guys have a hard time leaving professional sports. You hear about that quite a bit, or leaving, let's say you've been an Olympic athlete and then all of a sudden you didn't make the team or you aged out or whatever happens. And now your whole life was that. And now you're not that thing anymore. So how do you turn that page? How do you start that new chapter in life? And then for us, I thought, you know what? Let's pick up and leave Coronado, California, and make a physical and psychological break with the military and move up to the mountains and start this next chapter in life up here, raise our kids in a ski town. So that's what we did.
No, it's the same in law enforcement. It's you get used to that blue family and the camaraderie, and you know you're going to miss it when you leave. but you can do things to avoid that. So what part of being a dangerous individual, and make no mistake about it, if you're one of our special operators, we had the pleasure of working with Six and with Team Six and with Delta when we were in Columbia. Most impressive men I've ever met anywhere in my life. But what part of that gets romanticized by people who never had to live with it?
I think some of it is just what you get from television and film, especially back before there were other ways of connecting with people who had that life. Like growing up, there was no way for me to connect with a SEAL, no way for me to really connect with anyone in special operations. There was no one to ask any questions to. It was all popular culture. And then some of the nonfiction books started rolling out. Of course, before that, there was 5 Years to Freedom by Nick Rowe, who escaped in Vietnam. And so there was that. There was the Green Berets. There was a book called The Delta Force by Charlie Beckwith. There were a few things that leaked out. And then more and more late 80s, early 90s, more and more of these memoirs started coming out. So you could learn a little bit about special operations from those, but you couldn't like connect with them on social media or ask them a question or anything like that, because that obviously didn't exist. So you had to really take action. You had to really devote yourself to sitting down and reading that book, first searching it out, finding out it exists, and then sitting down and reading it, thinking about it. So I think the misconception is that there's like a cookie cutter type of a special operator. And when in reality, just like in any part of life, or any industry, everyone's different. I'm sure now you share something in common once you've been through SEAL training, when you've been through BUDS or SEAL qualification training or whatever else you share now, whatever your background was before that, now you have a shared experience. Just like anybody who goes to boot camp has the same experience. Anybody who goes through Marine Corps boot camp, they have something in common with every other Marine who has ever gone through that and whoever will go through that. So I think the misconception is that it's kind of like a cookie cutter type of a thing, and you all have the same skill sets and you're all kind of reprogrammed or whatever in boot camp and BUDS and your platoon or whatever, and you're all kind of the same, when in fact you're just as different as anybody in society at large. So I think that's probably the biggest misconception.
And just a side question to go with that. When you are out amongst the public, do you have a lot of people come up? And I know you get a million questions, just like I got a million questions for you today. We're going to run out of time before I get through most of them. But do you get people coming up saying, I always wanted to be a Navy SEAL, but...
yes, you do get that. And then today I get the I want to write a book type of a thing. My YouTube channel, I have a whole videos on, here's kind of here's my process. Here's, you know, some insights into the public industry, if it helps type of a thing. But, a lot of people want to ask about that and say, hey, I want to write a book. How do I do it? What do you suggest? Or I was going to be an author, or you need to get that too. And, you know, all those sorts of things. And, you know, it's very flattering that people want to ask me either about SEAL team stuff or about writing or about the TV shows, screenwriting, whatever it might be. So I feel extremely fortunate when people come up and ask me questions.
Dude, you've earned it. I mean, I know you're being humble here on the interview, and I appreciate that. But, and I'm pretty sure if I called you a hero, you wouldn't subscribe to that.
Yeah, definitely not.
Yeah. Well, that's part of what makes a hero a hero. They won't admit to it. You don't see yourself like that. So you passed the test there, in case you were wondering. Yeah. So in your opinion, what have you learned about evil that what we would refer to maybe as polite society, those who haven't, that they refuse to accept?
I think that just that it exists. It's been a part of our, not just our culture, but every culture and every mythology from the beginning of time. And there is something out there that's an innately evil. You see it in crimes. You see horrible crimes against just children or whatever else it might be. That it exists. It's a thing. And then, you know, what does that mean? There's an opposite to that. There's good in this world as well. And so that's why I think who once again, go back to those earlier days, or that age 8 to 18 or 10 to 20, when we had some good solid influences even before my generation. Guys are watching John Wayne out there, and then my generation, I'm watching Sylvester Stallone and as Rambo and Rocky get knocked down and get back up again. I mean, those are great lessons from the Rocky films. That's popular culture having a positive impact on an entire generation. And watching Arnold Schwarzenegger and Commando and Predator and, you know, all these things. And so those are great
influences, especially for young men, to realize that they get knocked down. And what do you do? Because a story where, well, the hero doesn't get knocked down, and that's not much of a story. And so the hero is going to get knocked down. He's going to be a reluctant hero, and he's going to have to get up and keep moving forward. So that's a great thing to see. So I think those popular culture influences, were positive. Now, juxtapose that to today with kids scrolling, doom scrolling, and being essentially manipulated by an algorithm that wants to enrage, that doesn't encourage any sort of compassion or empathy, because you're not putting yourself in someone else's shoes. And that's one of the great benefits of reading, is that whether you're reading fiction or not, but in particular fiction, you're putting yourself in someone else's shoes, and you're getting to know somebody else, and you're developing a compassion and empathy that's very difficult to develop any other way. On the screen as well, watching these films, you're losing yourself in this story, and you're developing this compassion and empathy for characters brought to life by actors on the screen. But now you're just getting enraged, and you're just flipping through this thing, whether it's X or whatever, X, TikTok, and whatever it is. But your brains are getting rewired that for that next generation. In fact, that algorithm is developing the opposite of compassion and empathy. And you can, you know, go to the comments section of essentially any post, doesn't matter what it is, just to get an illustration of that. So that, that does worry me. So, but I think it's that evil does exist. It is out there, and it's always going to need those guardians standing guard against it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. 100% agreement. And so in your books, what part of yourself gets to exist in fiction that cannot exist in public?
Well, I think you get to explore things more. You get to explore a thought process, and whether that's from the protagonist or even from an antagonist or a supporting character, depending on the story, you get to dive into a thought process, and you get to bring that person's, that character's background to their perspective. And that really allows you to get a good broad understanding, put yourself in the enemy's shoes, which is always important to do. Look at things from the enemy's perspective so that you can anticipate their next move, counter it. That's because warfare is a game of constant adaptation, but life's a game of constant adaptation as well. So doing that is incredibly beneficial. But for my character, James Reese, or in this case, it's Chris Walker, the protagonist of The Fourth Option, those guys are much better than I was at anything. So faster, stronger, shots, wittier, you know, all of those things. And but James Reese in particular shares my background as a prior enlisted SEAL sniper, becomes an officer, becomes a troop commander, and then the audience gets to meet him, or the readership gets to meet him when he's on his last deployment and he's going to be coming home and thinking about moving on to take care of his family. And that's where I was when I started writing The Terminal List. And then that has given me open doors to Hollywood, to screenwriting, to be able to write nonfiction, like with Targeted Beirut, and the next Targeted nonfiction book should come out in the early part of 2027. I haven't announced that topic yet, but the first one was on Beirut 1983, the Beirut barracks bombing, and really what's that meant for foreign policy ever since. Its shadow has loomed large, but I wanted to humanize it. I also wanted to humanize these different events when I write about them, because you hear something like 241 servicemen killed. That's a big number. But then you go into these stories about them and their families, and you get to humanize it and realize that decisions that are made at the strategic level certainly have tactical level implications, and those ripples will affect, are multi-generational. So the guys that were killed in Beirut 1983, they were sons, they were brothers, they were fathers, and those ripples, they go across the generation. So it's not just those guys and their families who are affected. It's multi-generational. So I wanted to humanize these terrorist events while also providing some sort of a foundation in order to assess current events. First one was Beirut 1983. Next one will be coming out here, and we'll announce that, I think, in the next couple months, what the topic of that is. But it's a heartbreaking one as well, because when you're researching Beirut, you're talking to these guys who are digging through the rubble for their buddies with their bare hands, with K-bar knives, with a crowbar or shovel if they could find it. And it's just, oh my gosh, it's also a rescue effort, one of the greatest rescue efforts in modern American history. So it's just incredible to talk to these guys and to capture their experience in a book like that. But anyway, I digress, which happens often when I get talking about books.
But this is your story. You know, and I tell you, your books are written, the good books that you read are the kind that as you're reading, at least for me, I'm a visual person. And the way, if they're written correctly, in my opinion, I can visualize. I'm actually in a scene in my mind as I'm reading the words in a book. And your books they meet that. I mean, it's as you're doing the newest one here, as I'm reading, I'm in the swamps of New Orleans, or I'm in downtown New Orleans, or you're in the French Quarter, or you're on Bourbon Street, all those different things. It's amazing how a successful and a qualified writer can evoke those thoughts in your brain. But that's what makes it interesting.
Thank you. And I don't want a guy like you to get drawn out of the story because all of a sudden there's a safety on a Glock or something like that. I'm not going to make those kind of mistakes that you see really more often than one would think. And you have to really fight to stay back in, or you have someone who's very experienced, calling a magazine a clip type of a thing, something that's obviously come from a mistake in a Hollywood type of a film or a mistake in another book that now an author thinks is how one would talk about firearms, when really it shows that the person talking about that said firearm has no idea either how to operate it, or that there's not a safety on a Glock, or that this is a magazine, not a clip, or whatever it might be. Some very basic mistakes get in there, and then they draw that person like you out of the story. And even if it's for a split second and you have to fight your way back into it, you're like, forgive the author this mistake, but this someone who is competent with firearms is not going to say this, or isn't going to take a safety off on a Glock. But okay, go back to the story. But I don't want you to get taken out by something like that. So for me, it's very important to get those details. And also the gear is important to me because gear tells me a story. I see somebody that is carrying a Cocton Lock 1911 and a leather holster on a leather belt. Maybe they're wearing Oakley sunglasses, or maybe they're wearing Ray-Ban like aviator type glasses, and they're wearing a certain kind of boot or whatever they're doing. That tells me something about their training, their level of competence, where they might have even got that training. And then somebody else, you see their, okay, I see their age. I see the type of hat they're wearing. I see the type of sunglasses they have on. I see the type of belt, this nylon belt, and I see a Kydex holster with a striker fire pistol. Okay, that tells me something about them that's different than the other person. Or I see someone that's just all messed up. This guy's trying to wear it to play a part and has really no idea what they're doing. But I can see that through the gear. Just like the kind of car someone drives tells you a little something about them. Type of watch that they wear tells you something about them. All of those things tell a story, but they have to be true to that character. And if you just didn't know what you were doing, you just looked up like Navy SEAL knife and something pops up and then, okay, my character's going to carry that. Well, maybe not in real life. And if a SEAL's reading that, they're going to be taken right out of the story because they're going to roll their eyes and say, oh, this person has no idea what they're talking about. And there's not that foundation of authenticity that's so important these days. It might not have been as important in the, let's say, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, if you're writing something, because as a reader, there wasn't a way to check on these things. But it certainly was important for the person who had lived that life. So that's why I want to get the DEA stuff right for somebody like you, the FBI stuff right for those guys, the special operator parts, the CIA parts, like right for those people who live those lives. And I think that's just important to that foundation of authenticity. So I'm trying to get that right.
Yeah, please don't change.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
I don't know how, so.
There you go. So, for you, what's harder to live with over time? Because you've seen some things that most people never see. Is it harder to live with what you did, what you saw, or what you became capable of doing?
I got very fortunate. I sleep very well at night, but I also understand the other side of it. And I'm not saying all the decisions I made downrange were right. Luckily, they turned out okay. Because if you're doing, let's say, if we're doing a sand table right here and we're doing, an exercise and we're marching, let's say, plastic soldiers into an ambush or something like that. And on the sand table, we're going to be maneuvering forces just to get a visual of what that looks like from a leadership perspective, if you're ground tactical leadership position. And on that sand table, you can make all the quote unquote right decisions and it comes out great. You did it.
Wonderful. You called in air. There happened to be those air assets there. You pushed your guys in the right direction in order to flank or whatever you did. You made the right decisions under fire on that sand table. Then you go out and you make those exact same decisions in real life and it goes downhill and it goes downhill. It yep. goes south. You lose people, people get wounded, whatever it might be, because the enemy gets a vote. And like I said earlier, it's that game of constant adaptation. So you could have made all the right decisions and still have things go poorly and be thinking about that for the rest of your life and thinking, what could I have done differently? How could I have prepared better, more, whatever it might be, whatever you're struggling with, when in fact, you made all the right decisions. It just happens to be that the enemy gets a vote. There's atmospherics of a gunfight. There are just weird things that happen. Luckily, that didn't happen to me. So I feel so fortunate. But I could have made all the wrong decisions. And they just happened to turn out right because of what the enemy did. I mean, that's possible too. So what I'm saying is that I understand that struggle. And even if it's not that person's fault, like there's no way it's their fault, but they still feel that responsibility. They feel that burden. And I understand that. So for me, I guess I've been training my whole life for it. And the goal, I mean, the role of the military is really to be prepared for war. And then when that call comes, then you go, but it's to be as prepared as you possibly can be. And I think that I don't know what else I could have done to prepare myself, but I prepared myself my whole life, not just to be in physical shape, but to do things on the outside. I didn't just rely on the military training, but anytime I could get to the range with somebody who's passing through town or passing through somewhere close by, I could go out and try to pick their brain, learn a little bit about their, what they could get, what value I could take on board and then take back to the team. I try to get to SHOT Show every year in Vegas to see just what type of things are out there that aren't yet in our system for whatever reason, but what's been out there on the in the private sector that can help us overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan and give us just a slight edge over our enemy. What books can I read? What after action reports can I read? What can I learn from, let's say, the Soviets in Afghanistan from the 1979 to 1989? I have a couple books on the shelf back there with some of their after actions from that time frame. So anyway. All that goes to say, like, I just wanted to be as prepared as I could possibly be. And I think that I did that. I want to be the best operator I could possibly be, the best leader I could possibly be. I want to be a better leader and operator today than I was yesterday. And then that transfers over to today. I want to be a better author today than I was yesterday. I want to be the next book to be better than this one. I want the next TV show to be better than the last one. It's a constant game of improvement going forward. I think that's how life should be in general. Learn from the lessons of the past and apply them to the current problem set as wisdom and always improve.
I like it. Was there, by the way, have you read all those books on those shelves behind you?
No, not all of them, but certainly a lot of them. And a lot of them I pull out for research. That's why I have shelves on Afghanistan, on Iraq, on the Civil War, on the American Revolution, on World War II, World War I. So they're kind of broken down like that. Terrorism, insurgencies, counterinsurgencies. So this is the nonfiction room. There's a couple of fiction over here. I have Fleming stuff right here. But then the other room over there, that's all fiction. And so I've separated it like that. But I've already outgrown it. You can tell there's some books kind of on their sides right there. I've already outgrown this library. So I need to expand, but yeah, they're all here. I love being surrounded by books. My mom was a librarian. I grew up surrounded by books and a love of reading. So I'm always building my library.
Good. Was there a moment in your life that changed you permanently, but it's something that other people didn't notice that it really mattered that much to you?
That is a very good question. I feel like I was thinking about this recently and I did think of something, and right now it's not coming to mind for whatever reason, but I know I was just thinking about this just the other day. What was that?
Either a military moment or as a writer or becoming a father, or becoming a husband.
I should say that in case my wife listens to this. So getting married and then when our children were born.
That's the safe answer.
My answer. I'm sticking to it.
Well, speaking of kids here, if someday your kids, they come to you and they say your books, they tell us what you did, but not who you were. What is it that you'd want them to know about you?
Well, what's interesting today is that unlike for previous generations, there's a body of interviews out there, both my podcast, talking to all sorts of different people, podcasts like this, that my kids, their kids, so my grandkids one day will be able to go to find out a little bit more about who their father was, who their grandfather was. My dad didn't have that. His father was killed in World War II, so we never met him. He was a Corsair pilot, flew off aircraft carriers in World War II. So he doesn't have that. And there was no Facebook to try to reach out to someone from your dad's squadron to see if you could find out a little bit more about him. And, you know, that generation really just got back to work after the war. And they built this country into what it is today. Wasn't a lot of whining. It was just like, hey, and even for the people who, the widows who lost their husbands, they were very practical, it seems to me. And they were very tough coming out of the Depression. So it was just a different mindset, I guess. And so my dad really never got to know his dad other than through, a couple mentions here and there. Whereas today, now, there's just all these interviews out there. So, I think, I guess, for going back to your question, though, I think I just want him to know that, I did the best I could, heart's in the right place. And, hope I did a good job.
Good. Well, again, a safe answer. I mean, the things that you've done for this country in service of your country, and now how you're portraying that over to you're bringing others in. It's not all about me. I'm going to write these books and it's all about me and I'm going to make all this money, but you're bringing in co-writers and you're using other people to make sure you get the facts straight. You're kind of sharing the wealth, in my opinion, which I think is very admirable, because we see a lot of people that don't. Right.
No, interesting. Well, yeah, I will say it's all altruistic. Like, targeted Beirut. Oh my gosh. James Scott is amazing. He's a historian, Pulitzer Prize finalist. I learned so much from him about research, the correct way to go into archives, handle certain primary source materials, how to correctly annotate that for the notes section, because I wanted that book to be, not pop history, but real history that people could go to for years and years. And if someone wants to know something about, or asks, hey, what book should I read on Beirut 1983? This is the one, Targeted Beirut. And we accomplished that. And he's working on that next one right now. And we were just talking about it yesterday. But he's just amazing. I'm learning so much from him. And in this case, MP Woodward for the fourth option. What a great guy. And what a great collaborator on this book. So I can't thank him enough. And the Handler, which is the book that I mentioned that I found him through, is so good. And hopefully people will find, his books, MP Woodward's books, through this, and then also for people to find James Scott's other books. He has five other books out there. Four of them are on World War II, and they're fantastic. They're on the shelf right over there. And they're just incredible. So, so great. So I hope through this that people will be able to find their other work as well and add them to their libraries.
Yep. I read somewhere that at age 7 or 10, you knew you wanted to be a special operator and you knew you wanted to be a writer. Is that true?
Yeah, at age 7, I knew I wanted to be a SEAL. Before that, I knew I wanted to join the military. I think it was just in my blood from an early age, possibly because I had those, essentially those artifacts of my grandfather. So I had the silk maps that they used to give the aviators in World War II, because if you hit the water with a paper map of, obviously, it's eventually going to deteriorate and disintegrate. So they had these silk maps, which of course just get wet. You can still use them. I had his wings. I had his medals. I had pictures of him and his squadron, him and with his plane. So I had all those things. But I think there's a calling, and I've been very good at listening to callings my entire life. I don't get talked out of things by anybody for whatever reason. I don't know why. But I knew I wanted to be a SEAL when I found out about them when I was 7 in second grade. And I found out about them through a movie called The Frogmen. So once again, the power of popular culture. I asked my dad about, hey, who these guys were. And he said, oh, they're frogmen, because that's the name of the movie. And I said, well, who are they? And they're like, you're climbing up over the beaches and blowing things up. And he said, ask your mother. And so my mom was a librarian. So I went to the local library and did a bunch of research. And I found out that SEALs are some of our most elite special operators, and the training was some of the toughest ever devised by a modern military. So I think both those things to a young person are a big draw. You want to test yourself and you want to test yourself. You want to be one of the best. So they had me from an early age. And then I'm reading everything I can possibly can on warfare, specifically on special operations. And then about fifth grade, I start to switch over from, let's say, the young adult fiction, so like the Farley Mowat type books, into the same kind of books that my parents are reading. So that's about the time that Hunt for Red October comes out. So I'm reading those kind of books at that point. And it keeps me on my path into the SEAL teams. But I'm loving those books, the fiction. I'm loving the Tom Clancy's and the Nelson DeMille's and the H.G. Wells, J.C. Pollock, Michael, all those guys. I'm just loving those books so much that I tell myself, hey, when you get out of the military, you're going to write books like this. And it never was even a question if I would be successful or not, because every book that I'm reading seems like it's successful. It says number one New York Times bestselling author on the top. And that's what you're seeing at that young age. I guess it just gets imprinted, not just the, the story arcs and, three act structures and all that stuff that you just kind of get by reading. Other things get imprinted there as well. And for me, it was like, I'm going to be a SEAL and I'm going to write thrillers that are quote unquote successful, but I don't even think of things in those terms, but I guess it's terms people can understand. I just wanted to be an author and a number one New York Times bestselling author. And I wanted those books to be adapted to the screen. And so now that those things have happened, it's all about improving.
Well, have any of your kids told you what they're going to do when they grow up yet?
Well, I don't want to put them in a bad position just because they hear it. You know, people ask me those questions when they're around. And, you know, I tell the truth about how I knew what I wanted to do from an early age. But I'm hoping that it doesn't make them feel like, oh, geez, if I don't know what I want to do right now, that's a problem. And I try to say, I don't know many people that knew what they wanted to do from an early age. I'm sure there's tons of them, but I don't know that many that stuck with it type of a thing. I'm sure there's especially astronauts, a typical one. As a kid, you want to be an astronaut. And then somewhere along the line, you get the talked out of it, or someone tells you you need to be good at math. And you're like, whatever that is that derails you from that dream when you're a little kid staring up at the moon or whatever your stars, whatever it is that inspires you. Maybe it's a film, maybe it's a book. But I don't want them to feel that pressure. Just mm-hmm. because I knew. I want to say it's very natural not to know and to explore. And this is really all about the journey and the company you keep along the way. Look at it that way. And eventually you'll find that thing, that passion. And once you find it, that important thing is to listen to that call. If you're called to do something, don't get talked out of it. Listen to that voice. There's a reason that we've had the sixth sense that's kept us alive for millennia. And that's because we had ancestors that were good at the hunting and good at the fighting, and they listened to that sixth sense. So in this case, when you hear something like that, that's kind of an intangible, that's calling you to an action or whatever it is, listen to that. And don't get talked out of it by a media, by an algorithm, by a person, whatever, by yourself. Just follow that passion, explore that passion. And once again, it's about that journey and that company you keep along the way. Focus on that. And also think about those people who sacrificed everything from the inception of this country up until today to give you the options and opportunities to do these things, and always respect that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Life's an adventure, man. Just if you got a passion, follow it. See, if it doesn't go anywhere, it doesn't go anywhere, but at least you checked it out.
At least you're not 90 looking back and saying, if only I tried that thing that I wanted to do when I was 8 and I had the opportunity, you know, I just didn't follow it for whatever reason. So I think wondering, you know, that would be bad. But if you try it, it doesn't work, then you're 90 and you're like, hey, you know what? That would have been so great if it worked out, but I gave it my best shot and it didn't work. But something else did, or whatever it is. So give it a shot. Listen to that voice.
I agree. What strengths do you hope your children inherit from you, and what strengths do you hope they don't?
I think it's that resiliency piece, which is so, so important to just know you're going to get knocked down. And it's okay. You are going to get knocked down by life. What's important is not that you just get back up, because you have to. Eventually you'll have to. You can't stay on the mat. But it's also how you get back up, and how you get back up and influence those people around you by the way with which you conduct yourself as you're getting back up after being knocked down. That's important. Those details are important. So I think any of that resiliency piece, that's important. And what if what they don't get from me? I guess I should be more practical about things, but I don't know if it's good or, for me, it's not good, because so I'm not a businessman. I would say I'm a good entrepreneur, meaning I can read the battlefield and I can adapt to that battlefield. So I can look at publishing, and I can then adapt to this new era of publishing that's very different than the 70s, 80s, 90s, even early 2000s. I can adapt to that evolving battle space. But when it comes to things like budgets, I haven't paid a bill since 2000. So that's when my wife and I got married, and I went on deployment and never paid another bill. She just took it over. And then so she did web bill pay. I know no passwords. I have no idea income. I just focus on the books and being a better author today than I was yesterday. And so that's not
common, I don't think, with some other people I've talked to. I'm sure there's plenty of authors who that I just don't know that also don't pay attention to these things. But I never paid attention to them in the SEAL teams. I just had a general idea. You know, I knew that after every deployment, I could probably afford to get a new pistol or something like that to commemorate that that deployment. So I always did that, get a new blade of some sort to commemorate that deployment. But, you know, I know I wasn't going to be, you know, I wasn't going to be flying private, certainly, you know, but that's generally just how I looked at those sorts of things. So maybe a little better understanding of, you know, finances and business and spreadsheets and that sort of thing would be beneficial. But I also know what I'm not good at. I'm not good at that stuff. I don't want to get better at that stuff. I'm going to focus on the things that I'm good at, and you want to get better at those things. So, yeah, I don't know. That's a very strange way of me answering that question, I guess. But I guess I like to maybe a little more practicality, I guess, would be good. I don't know.
Well, I think part of it has to do with recognizing your weaknesses and your strengths.
Yeah, I certainly know those are important in life in general, to know your capabilities and your limitations. Yeah. So about having a force or being a sniper or whatever it might be, to know your capabilities and your limitations, because you're going to fall to the level of that training, not rise to the level of the moment in most cases. But I know mine.
Very good. There's one more question about the when people read your books, do you ever worry that the readers, that they might, I mean, really get into the vengeance side, the revenge part of this thing and the writings without fully understanding the cost of what that it, in real life, what that would cost a real person?
So I met one of my literary heroes, I guess over a decade ago. Yeah, definitely over a decade ago now, at SHOT Show. And I was still in the military at the time. I still had many years to go. So I didn't even tell him as I worked my way through the line that I wanted to be an author one day. I just wanted to meet Vince Flynn. And I just love Vince Flynn's novels. He started with Term Limits. And that was a book that doesn't have Mitch Rapp in it, who's his continuing series character, who will come be introduced in the next novel and then be the character that continues on through all the rest of them. But Vince Flynn passed away back in 2013. And his books are just incredible and were so impactful to me, but in particular, Term Limits. And so I got up to the front of that line and I was the last one for some reason, or I stayed behind or something like that. And it was at the end of SHOT Show. So anybody who's been to SHOT Show know that, especially back then, that once those doors or once they turned the lights off or blinked the lights or whatever, at the end of the day, it takes a long time to get out of that place, especially then. I was there just this last year. It's a little easier to maneuver now. But back then at the height of the show, oh my gosh, so height of the war, height of the show, it was jam-packed and it was very difficult to get out of that thing. It was like cattle getting herded out of that thing. And so I got to walk out with him and we got to talk on the way out, and he was so gracious, so kind. And I remember asking him, hey, do you ever wake up and think that someone is going to use Term Limits as a blueprint? And he said, every single day. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. But I don't concern myself with that, because for me, I just want to write the best book that I possibly can, not have any of those other factors come into play as I'm writing. I never think about the audience. I never think about what's going to be popular or unpopular. I never think about, hey, are shorter chapters better these days because of attention spans, or longer chapters or whatever. I don't think about any of those things. I don't think about who I'm going to upset or none of that. It's all about the story. And if I focus solely on the story, then in turn, I'm honoring that readership who's spending time with me that they're never going to get back. And that's something I take extremely seriously. So I know some authors out there take fan input and, you know, are writing for their fans. I do not do that. I write for the story. And if I write for that story, then if I make that story the best it can possibly be, and my heart and soul goes into every word, then I'm honoring that reader that's spending time with me in those pages, or today listening to the audiobooks.
Well, you must be doing something right, because your book's pretty popular.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, I should stick with how I'm doing things.
Well, it's working for you. That's fantastic. You know, so one of the things I enjoy about the people that I bring here on the show is hearing, you know, these studs and studettes, they risk their own lives for their fellow man, most of who don't even know them or are not aware of what they've gone through. But then when it's time to lay your sword down, what they get to do afterwards. And it's so heartening to see them go into a different line of work, just like you're doing, being an author, whatever it might be, starting their own companies, just continuing to support autism, whatever their charitable, heartfelt mission is. It's just amazing. Human trafficking, things like that. It just really amazes me and it encourages me. I'm a big believer in what Martin Luther King said, keep hope alive. We've got to do that. Do you by any chance remember that moment in your life that you think changed you permanently? That come back to you?
No. I mean, I think
I'm going to edit this out, so don't worry.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a, I think, yeah, no, it's just been a journey. I just take the failures of the past, even the successes of the past, but still draw lessons from them and apply them to, that's what I'm doing today. But for me, it's all about being a better citizen, husband, father today than I was yesterday, just like it was about being a better operator and leader every day in the SEAL teams. So that being a better author. So it's all those things. I think those, that mindset kind of follows over, but yeah, there wasn't like the a struck by lightning type of a moment. Of course, when we're off this, I'll probably think of something immediately. That's how I feel. That's why I'm an author, because you can think about, you leave an argument and you're like, you walk away and you know, 2 minutes later, you're like, oh, the perfect thing to have said. Witty and smart. How did I miss that? Well, as an author, I can do that. I can sleep on it. I can edit. I can think of the perfect thing for my protagonist to say at the right time. But that takes time. So anyway, that's the reason I'm an author. And you mentioned public speaking earlier, and that's not, every now and again, I'll do something, but not very, very rarely. I just don't like it. It's just not my thing. I think I made the price so outrageous that no one can possibly afford it.
Well, you go and speak at book events, right?
Right. And that's just part of the book event.
So if you had it to do all over again, what would you change, if anything?
Oh man, you ask tough questions. This pertains to your other question, because I was thinking of these in tandem the other day, and they do pop up, and I do think of something, and then I immediately forget it. Just because I don't know, I don't dwell, I guess, on those mistakes of the past. I mean, and it's interesting to, you know, get to say that if I'm essentially a student of history. I'm definitely not a historian, but I'm a student of history, student of all these things. But I don't dwell, I guess. And I think that comes from, and I remember my mom always telling us, hey, you know, if we're complaining about anything or whatever else, let's say, buck up, you know, like, hey, you know, move forward, quit dwelling on that. It's done. That rounds down range type of a thing. You know, pick yourself up and move forward, quit whining. So
I heard that a lot. Well, so in your military career, would you have done anything different?
I probably would have stayed enlisted if I didn't make the decision to become an officer before September 11th. Before September 11th, I decided to throw my hat in the ring for officer candidate school. So I did that. But if September 11th had happened in, let's say, January of 2001 instead of September 2001, then I doubt I would have continued down that path, because I would have thought, oh, I need to stay enlisted because now we're in this fight and I want to stay in this fight as long as I possibly can. I was already on my way to OCS, so it was really, you know, pulling that back. But then I got extremely fortunate in that I got right to my next team and I went right to Afghanistan. And then it was for a junior officer. The timing was good, I should just say. And I feel very fortunate that I was able to do ship boardings in the Northern Arabian Gulf, that I was able to go to Afghanistan. I was going to Iraq multiple times, Southern Philippines. I was having to have a couple other experiences, which weren't deployments because they were shorter, to places like Uzbekistan or Haiti, that sort of a thing. So I feel extremely fortunate that I was able to, I guess, come of age in the SEAL teams at a time when we were doing the job. So I would change if I could go back, I'd probably stay enlisted the whole time. But that wasn't in the cards. So I made the best of it, and it happened to work out. I happened to be very fortunate with where I was sent and what I was able to do. So anyway, just feel fortunate that I was able to be part of that team for as long as I was at the tactical level.
Excellent. So we're coming up here on the end. Are there any words of wisdom or advice you would offer anybody that's considering a life in the military or as a first responder or just a higher risk occupation?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot, but one, to do it. Don't talk yourself out of it. If you feel that
calling. Second one is to read, to be a student, to be a lifelong learner, because you're stepping into a learning organization in all of those organizations that you just mentioned right there. And so be that student, be that person who's prepared, who wants to improve every single day. And a big way to do that is through books. I guarantee, no matter what you want to get into, that your life, you'll lead a richer, fuller life if you wake up in the morning and crack open a book and don't go right to your phone to get manipulated by an algorithm. So I would certainly do that. And then the same thing I tell my kids, never miss an opportunity to make somebody's day. That doesn't mean you have to like go running around the world, you know, opening doors for everyone. But it does mean that if you notice something, then go ahead and make that person's day. Why not? Don't avoid it. And that comes back to, I didn't mean for this to happen this way, but the SEAL teams, as I was at that training command as the operations officer, I found out a SEAL was getting out, and Jared Shaw, and I found him on the grinder, which is our area where we do the push-ups and sit-ups and get sprayed down by the hoses and all that stuff that people may have seen on Discovery Channel. And he was an instructor at Buds in first phase. And I said, hey, Jared, drop by my office and, you know, we can talk through you getting out of the military. And we sat down and he told me what he wanted to do. And we talked through it, and I introduced him to people in the private sector. And then I followed up on it with him, I guess. And then I forgot all about it. And then 5 years later, in the fall of 2017, before my first book comes out, he calls me and says, hey, do you remember me? And of course I did. And he said, do you remember what you did for me in the SEAL teams? And I couldn't remember. You know, I always wanted to help people, whether they were staying in or getting out. And he said, hey, you're the only person that did that for me in the SEAL teams. And it is something that I saw. I saw when people said they were going to get out, they were going to another pile. And, you know, that train's moving forward. And that's just, you know, I don't know, we have this culture in the SEAL teams, or we did then anyway, that if you wanted to get out, it was almost akin to ringing the bell and quitting. And so it was a very strange thing. I never looked at it that way. I'm just like, hey, this guy's, if anybody's a good person, good operator, good leader, whatever it is, I'm going to help them. If they want to stay in, I'm going to help them if they want to get out. And you know, that's just natural for me to do that. So I didn't think anything of it. But then he calls me and says, hey, thank you. No one else did that for me. I really appreciate it. And I said, hey, no problem. How's it going? And he says, going great, but I heard you wrote a book. And I said, yeah, I did, but it's coming out in a few months. So I can send you this galley copy. And I probably found out what a galley copy was just a few weeks before that or something. And he said, that'd be great, but I'd like to give it to a friend of mine. And I said, yeah, who's that? And he said, Chris Pratt. And I was like, oh. That certainly is convenient for me, because I pictured Chris Pratt playing this role as I was writing it, as I started writing it back in December of 2014, before Guardians of the Galaxy, before Jurassic World, back when Chris Pratt was in Parks and Rec and had a small role as a SEAL in Zero Dark 30. And so I saw him lose that weight, get in shape, saw the acting chops, and thought, this will be the person that stars in my book as we adapt it to the screen. And so anyway, that goes back to, I didn't mean for that to happen that way. And I'm not saying that everybody you open the door for or lend a helping hand to is we're going to come back to you. That's certainly not the reason to do it. And that certainly wasn't the reason I was helping Jared with whatever small help I was able to lend. But it certainly came back around, and we're dear friends today. Me, Jared, Chris are dear friends, and we're making these TV shows and, you know, looking at other projects and all the rest of it. So I would say never miss an opportunity to make somebody's day.
Great advice, and not expecting anything in return. That's fantastic. So before I let you go here, is there anything that I haven't mentioned that you want to bring up?
Oh my goodness. Well, our podcast will be dropping soon if it's not already out by the time this podcast drops. So, did your close podcast about the fourth option. And that was super. That was just such an honor to be able to talk to you on that. And
thank
I really
you.
Appreciate you taking time to do it. And appreciate all you've done for this nation and what you're continuing to do right now, your book and doing things like this. I mean, people will hear it, and some kid in junior high school, college, will hear it and be like, oh, that sounds really interesting. I want to get that book. And they'll read that book and say, you know what? I think I'm going to go to law school. I'm going to become a police officer with a goal of someday joining the DEA and doing something like you did. And so that's so important. So I really appreciate you being one of those voices of positivity and light for the next generation, because they certainly need it.
Thank you, brother. Means a lot coming from you. And ladies and gentlemen, if you want to find out more about Jack Carr, where to find him, but I'm going to give these to you real quick. His website is officialjackcarr.com. His podcasts, plural, are Danger Close, the Terminal List podcast, and the Jack Carr Book List podcast. On YouTube, you can find him at Jack Carr USA. Instagram, Jack Carr and Jack Carr Book Club and Danger Close Podcast. On Facebook, Jack Carr USA, TikTok, Jack Carr USA, X Jack Carr, LinkedIn, Jack Carr.
Should be Jack USA across the board. Should be Jack Carr USA across the board on everything. But I'm on X myself and Instagram myself, and then my team will take those and repost them to Facebook because three was just too many, and I have no idea. I think we just got the TikTok account so that no one else could get it. But primarily Instagram and X, and then those things are going to be posted on Facebook, but I don't even know how to use Facebook. So I just have to Instagram and X as a way to reach out and thank people to make comments. I really appreciate it when people take the time to follow me or to tell me that they the book resonated with them, or the TV show did, or the podcast, or whatever it is. So I try to get on there every day and at least hit that heart button and try to say thank you to as many people as I possibly can, because I sincerely appreciate it.
Excellent. Excellent. So if you listen to this on audio, come on over to YouTube, check it out, gameofcrimespodcast.com, hit the subscribe button. If you're watching this on YouTube, there's a placard up showing you where you can find Jack Carr. You really don't need that. I mean, he's that well known that I think you can just find him by type. I Googled Jack Carr and found a million different things on him. So Jack, just before we go here, thank you so much for your service to our country. You're a true American and a patriot. You're continuing to serve others now through your writing, taking care of your family. Sounds like you got your priorities in order. It's been a real honor to hoot to be on your show and to have you here on Game of Crimes. Thank you, sir.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
All right. And for all the listeners, thank you for coming back every week. I couldn't do any of this without you. You guys are loyal. The show's growing. I appreciate everything you're doing for me. Don't quite understand continually how you come back or why you come back, but in all honesty, I do. It's because you enjoy playing the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all, and that's our Game of Crimes. God bless everybody. We'll see you next week.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.